The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Daniel Coffeen is a rhetor and a philosopher. If by philosopher you mean somebody who plays with concepts and ideas. He formerly taught at UC Berkeley and at the SF or San Francisco Art Institute, but now spends his time writing and consulting. Coffeen is a frequent guest to the Zero Squared podcast and was a guest to Diet Soap before this one started, and his book Reading the Way of Things is now out from Zero Books. A review of his book on Amazon sums it up nicely. Quote, Coffeen throws the act of reading into such a dizzying light that I can't rightly say when I began reading the book. Was it when it slid from the envelope, announcing itself in its bold lime green cover? In one sense, yes, as that marked the beginning of the physical reading event. But in another sense, a different reading started when I first heard Coffeen on the Partially Examined Life podcast 6 months prior. And a different sense of reading began when I picked up Anti-Oedipus on a Lark in Morningside Heights, New York, 17 months ago. Reading is an event, an interplay between text and reader, where both are always already in motion, hooking up to one another and creating new relations. It's Wednesday, August 31st, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Starting next week, we'll be launching the Zero Books membership site, which will include a members-only weekly podcast, tentatively titled Inside Zero Books, monthly workshops on critical theory and politics, often set up around Zero Books, Zero Book titles, and quarterly audiobooks from our Advancing Conversations series, and for a slightly higher monthly rate, an invitation-only writing workshop. That is, you have to submit a work of yours, a piece of writing, in order to be admitted and thereby charged more. In this episode, you'll hear the voice of Rick Roderick, the theme from the 70s television show Taxi, a clip from John Berger's Ways of Seeing, and an excerpt from a speech from Manuel de Landa, a Deleuzian. The music you're listening to right now is from John Berger's Ways of Seeing. It's the Ways of Seeing intro music on a loop. But in just a moment, you'll be hearing from Daniel Coffeen and I as we discuss Reading the Way of Things. Daniel Coffeen is a philosopher. If by philosopher you mean somebody who plays around with big abstract ideas, he is a Deleuzian, a freelancer, and a branding specialist, and an anti-capitalist of sorts. Coffeen has been a regular guest on both this podcast and on the Diet Soap podcast before this one, and he's about to become a Zero Books author. His book, Reading the Way of Things, is due out from Zero Books in August. So, Daniel Coffeen, welcome back to Zero Squared.
Thank you, good sir.
It's been a fun process. You know, it's sort of remarkable, I think, that years ago we started out, you were talking to me on my tiny little Diet Soap podcast, and now you're on this tiny little Zero Squared podcast. But through that, I've managed to get a book out of you. So I'm really pleased to have that happen. But it really turns out that what got this started for you wasn't Diet Soap. I like to pretend it was that, but it was this course at Berkeley that you taught that ended up on iTunes.
It's this idea, sort of this moment I had back in grad school. Was, you know, I really wrestled in grad school, and I was originally going to write about irony and the ironic life and Kierkegaard. And then I read Deleuze late in my graduate career, and I had to pause. Everything sort of stopped for me. And I couldn't write or think. And it was just a sort of a, from the perspective of the university, a dead year for me, because I wasn't writing and I wasn't really taking classes. I was just reading Deleuze, trying to understand it. And then I just whole world sort of shifted for me into what I'm calling like reading the way of things, into really understanding immanence and seeing how things flow. And it was my dissertation, but my dissertation poured out of me sort of in this very unwieldy way. It's really just, I got to get this out. And it was sort of a mess. So when it came time to teach the class, I was forced to sort of have some time, think about it, and then structure it as a pedagogy and explain it. And so it took this kind of form of, and this sort of articulation or elaboration of ideas and concepts and how they all sort of fit together to become this way of reading things. And so it was really the course in a lot of ways, just structurally, that let me think better and write this book rather readily.
So were you writing your dissertation at the same time that you were teaching this course on rhetoric?
No.
No.
Now they were about 5-6 years apart. I was teaching while I was a grad student. And I was teaching comp, and a lot of these things are in there, but it hadn't sort of elevated itself up to a concept, to a way, if that makes sense, right? Like I had some tactics and some things I wanted to get over, and they make their way in there. In the present book, in the Zero Books book, I include, in the chapter on how to teach it, things that I told my students back when I was teaching comp as a grad student in the 90s. If students in my class use the word also, or in addition, they lost a full grade.
Now, why is that?
Because I was trying to make them create an argument, not a list of evidence, that the way people are taught and the way I became immediately apparent to me, teaching comp, teaching freshmen at, and they're Berkeley and they've all done well. They all write these papers. And what they do is they have these sweeping general claims. And then they list their evidence. And I was like, I don't want that. I want a tour through the book. I want you to bring this book to life in a new way. No sweeping generalizations. I want you to move from particular to particular to particular, and form a kind of movement through the book. And those involve turns of thought, shifts. So words like but, or on the other hand, right? We set something up and then you flip it around. Or one of my favorite go-to phrases is, that is to say, where you say something and then you dive a little deeper and you qualify it. If you use a word like also is not a relationship.
Right.
In addition, it's not a relationship. That they're literally just it's just adding things up, right? Plus this plus this, and then they're always taught in the end to say in sum. I'm like, no, this isn't an algebra problem.
Right.
This is not an arithmetic problem. Like, no in sum.
It's like you're setting up you're creating a set. You're trying to make an argument, but you're not going to make an argument. So you say something like commodity culture enforces norms on the viewer. Right. And then you say there was an advertisement that featured certain beauty standards. Also, there was a Coca-Cola design that, that's what you wanted to get away from.
Yes. And I wanted them to find connections between things that were more interesting, more tension between the elements, rather than just a list. And that was definitely the number one problem, number one issue students faced. I taught comp for 10 years. It's 20 classes, like far and away. Number one thing that students think that critical writing is, and clearly they've been taught this because they've succeeded and they've gotten to Berkeley, is you make a big sweeping argument and then you just list your evidence.
Right. And it's sort of this naive understanding of empirical science that might be behind that approach.
Exactly.
Did you find that other teachers had a similar problem and felt the same way?
Yeah. I mean, I think we responded to it differently. But I think that's what sort of tied us all together in the rhetoric department, was that we really approached text. It would really separate us from philosophy. And I think you and I have talked about this in the past, that, you know, in the, that we always consider the style, you know, the actual writing of the book is matters, right? So the, and the form of the book. So shifting students away from just trying to abstract out these general ideas to really get them to wrestle, with the text itself and how it operates. So yeah, I wasn't unique to me, although we didn't all conspire that way. It took me a long time, and having a lot of TAs and realizing that we thought the same way. Like, this is why we're all in this department. But I went on to make it a structure, right? Or make it a course, make it a dissertation.
Well, it seems to me that you don't have to make that next step to focusing on style to still reject this approach where you're just collecting evidence. I mean, you could, like in most philosophical books, you start out with setting up a question or a problem, or you set up an argument, and then you develop your book or your ideas by seeing what the ramifications of that argument would be. So, the one that comes to mind for me most easily would be Descartes' Meditations, and he says, "I'm going to doubt everything." So it's an approach, and then he starts to go through all the things he can doubt. Maybe there's going to be a few alsos in there. I can also doubt this, but it seems very different than just collecting evidence at that point.
Yeah, and of course Descartes can use the word also. I think he's earned the right to use also.
Yeah, right.
But these students, I just really need to push them off. But the point of that is that's. In this book now, so a lot of my pedagogy shows up in this thinking and in this book, and the teaching really, I taught myself, you know, which I know is maybe sort of a parody of what teachers always say. It's really, I learn in there. Right. And I wasn't learning from the students, I got to be honest.
Right.
The student never taught me a freaking thing, but the act of teaching taught me relentlessly. It taught me a ton. One thing I would say about rhetoric, and people always, again, I was always asked, you know, what's rhetoric? But I was like, it's a theory and a practice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what I think separates, you know, it's not just craft. It's not just building the argument, but it's also knowing why you build the argument. At some point, the two can't be separated. And so I think there was in the act of teaching these ideas and then having it always become manifest, always have to be practiced, always having to be expressed through a particular thing. So every time I was taught a particular text. It wasn't just I'm teaching an idea. We taught, it was always an object we were reading, and then something I had to say about it, perform a reading of it, and then the students had to perform their readings of it. And we try to sort of open up and unlock this unlock's the wrong word, explode, multiply this particular thing. So there was always this practice. And this movement from these ideas to this practice, right? And then, of course, from the practice to the ideas. And so in this constant sort of iteration of my ideas, they began to take a little shape and get a little inflection and take on a kind of life, if that makes sense.
What do you think the difference is between teaching composition and rhetoric and teaching creative writing?
Oh, it's funny you should ask. I've talked to a couple creative writer teachers recently here in the Bay Area. And I asked them all this exactly. I think that they face the two people I talked to, and it was within the same week. It was really weird. People in creative writing really go towards emotion. And so their students are always see it as sort of like psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. And then it's their job, these teachers of creative writing, to sort of teach the form. They're like, okay, you're feeling all that. That's great. But how are you going to express this? What's the voice? How do people relate? What's going to happen?
Uh-huh.
In that sense, it's similar to what I was doing, except that the object wasn't what they're feeling, but a text. So we're looking at Nietzsche and, you know, or John Austin or William Burroughs, whatever I was teaching that semester. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the first things I had to get rid of is I don't care about your opinion. Right. And I think these creative writers face that too. It's like, you might be all worked up about how you were raised, and that's great, but that's not what we're doing in this class. you're creating something else. And you can have all those emotions, but they don't, and they have to take a form in the story you're writing. So it was the same, in a way, for the critical writing, where it's, okay, we're reading this text, you might have all these different ideas and all these different feelings and all these different reactions, and you might be, yeah, but that doesn't do anything for anybody. You gotta, it's about taking a form and a practice of writing critically. So instead of doing narrative and character and cause and effect, there's a different set of figures, a different craft, but it is just a craft, and it's, you know, turning these inchoate sort of vague emotions and, rambling ideas into something, into a shape, into an argument rather than a story.
After all, it's that idea that allows us to give our students B's and C's as opposed to the I. But words have their functions. They're, to use Derrida's phrase, they're disseminating meanings apart from those intentions. Now, let's don't caricature his claim. This does not mean that we cannot intend. We can, but it means we cannot fix meaning by our intentions. This is very important when we read a text by an author in philosophy, because we're frequently led to ask the question, what did he intend to say? And a deconstructive reading will lead us in the direction of not what did he intend to say, but what are these physical marks? How can I interpret these physical marks? To use that example, and that, by the way, is an anti-hermeneutic remark. It's a remark sort of against what might be called the idea that there could be the right interpretation. This is another important part of Derrida's take on language and language practices. The idea that there could be the right interpretation. In a way, there's no more powerful idea in the discipline of philosophy than the idea that there can be the right interpretation.
We're taught a certain way of making sense that is hierarchical, that is categorical, and two-dimensional or three-dimensional, right? It's geometric, and everything's got to fit in its place, and I have my axiom, my abstract, and then my list of evidence, as opposed to the flow and movement, which we have no problem talking about in creative writing, but I think it is part of every interaction between anything, right? We are temporal creatures. And so trying to introduce the flow of argument and being able to read the flow of a text, right? Rather than just abstracting its argument, just rather than sifting away the words and everything to get to the nugget, you got to make sense. Whatever Nietzsche's saying, the rhythm, his hilarious emphatic asides, his use of figures, all that stuff matters. Right, is constitutive of the texture, if you will, of the book. Trying to teach people writing critically that is also that's your job too. That's not adorning the text. It's not like you have some big idea and then you just want to make it sound pretty. Your movement of your writing is your critique. Right? Choosing an anecdote versus coming out with an axiom. You know, an abstract to begin are two fundamentally different ways to approach a book. You end up with a different argument.
You've compared your book to John Berger's ways of seeing.
Yeah.
And in that book, he wants to point out that the way we view the world is always sort of formally structured as well. There is no natural way to see things, that we see things through structures of mediation. And that these things seem natural to us, but are in fact constructed by history and politics and economics and sexual politics and all of that. So this seems to me like one way in which your book is very similar to his, and so much as you're pointing out the same thing, that there is no simple way, like just writing a list of presenting an idea that isn't going to also influence what that idea is. I think John Berger's way of seeing would say something similar.
Yes.
What is the difference, though, between your book on reading and his book on seeing. What's the difference between reading and seeing?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, I think reading supersedes seeing. I think seeing is a kind of reading. The obviously big difference is in our books is that, you know, he's really coming at it, you know, with a very particular focus on gender, and a certain, you know, he says, you know, seeing is ideological, and he has a different kind of ideology. And, you know, I think what I'm trying to say, and so obviously I have an ideology, but I'm trying to make the ideology of ideologies. And that while, you know, I don't want to say that writing hierarchically is wrong. I just want to point out that it's just another way of reading the world, that it's not the way to read the world, that the very thing you take for granted is not, pure or natural. I think Bird was saying, we see this way, you think it's natural, but it's actually highly ideological and coded with capitalism, patriarchy. So don't see that way. And it's similar. I'm not saying that something that different. I suppose, right? Where I'm like, yeah, this is the hierarchical reading, teleological reading, was I think your word for it, which I like a lot, tied up into an institutional discourse of a certain kind of power, no doubt, you know. In Death of the Author, Roland Barthes talks about it. You know, he says, you know, it's premised on, you know, authorship, which is a kind of hierarchical reading, right? Where the author stands above his text and dictates meaning downwards, right? As opposed to them being equal, right? Which I would suggest they're both just texts, as opposed to one being the master of the other. And that sort of master, architecture, there's an expert, right? So you have the whole academy, the whole pedagogic institution is founded on, the idea that somebody knows this better, is a master. So if James Joyce is the master of Ulysses, and as opposed to him just being irrelevant to you, to Ulysses, then, you know, whoever's writing about James Joyce and is, written the definitive book is the master of Joyce, and it just sort of keeps going up. And then the institution has sanctioned him, you know, and Bard argues that it replicates the sort of, you know, the church model, the priest model, where you need a conduit to understand the word of God because the flock is too stupid. You know, where, so my emphasis is really on trying to sort of radically democratize making sense of the world, right? And bringing in the amateur to just make whatever sense they make, while Berger's looking at a very particular kind of seeing, and, you know, and what he sees is a kind of, again, a very particular power dynamic that he's trying to undo.
Yeah. So, well, you know, when you talk about teleological writing or reading, for me, the first person to pop into my head is Terence McKenna, who had this idea. He had a variety of ideas, but he was big into this 2012 will be the end of history notion, which obviously I think has been discredited. I mean, maybe our calendars were wrong. But what he said, one of the most fascinating things for me that he ever said is that we've got the wrong idea about history, that we think that one cause, you know, is followed by an effect. But in fact, the Big Bang is at the end of history. What we're experiencing is the consequences. Basically, we're being pulled towards the end of history, and that ending is actually the creative force in society, or in society, in the universe. All that we think is a causal chain going one way is actually a causal chain going backwards. And if you're writing a novel, you can approach your novel that way. You can think, okay, this is where I want everything to get to. My job is to start somewhere and then get to the end. And that ending then will shape everything that happens before it. If you are writing a philosophical book and you have an argument that you're building up to, that you're going to kind of conclude with, the same thing can happen. You're starting out, you find a place to begin so that you can then make your way towards this big revelatory argument at the end. It almost seems to me that if you're going a different way, one different way would be to say, I have a collection of ideas.
Yes.
So, that would be a book where you go, and, or also, and,
So. Yeah. That's a Deleuzian move, you know, the and to infinity.
Right, and, but so and. Why were you against the also from the students, but you like the also when it comes to Deleuze?
Because it's all about how you're using the tools, man. It's like you got to know how to use them.
Okay.
It's like giving a 17-year-old who got all A's by writing this nonsense in high school, handing him nunchucks, you know, just wasn't.
Right. Okay. So you have to start him with arguments and hierarchical, you know, thinking and, you know.
Or not, or getting him out of hierarchy, because hierarchy would lend itself to this and. I mean, and before they, I wanted to get them into cohesion before they could really open up into more loose structures. But I never wanted their papers to have this definitive thing. Here's an example. My kid is working on a report, and it's not a report. It's like he goes to this very cool schools, and they have these projects, and you kind of have to create your own project. And he's trying to create a life form that could exist under the conditions of Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so he's trying to be all true to it. But then I asked him at one point, well, what separates the thing you're telling me from the planet? It just sounds like another thing. What makes it life? And then they're talking about human life in his class. And so he started researching consciousness. And he's like, Dad, I keep reading all these different takes. People say so many different things. And I gave him my Bergsonian take, which is that, you know, the brain is just a switchboard, just an operation like anything else, like an amoeba or a jellyfish. And he was flustered because he thought he needed to have an answer.
Right.
And I said to him, no, just lay it all out, right? That's okay just to lay it out. Give it a structure of how all these things could fit and the implications if you go one way or another. Right? You don't have to have that will to be definitive. Right. So it was this fine line in teaching critical writing for me, because it was like, I want you to be coherent, but I don't want you to be monolithic.
You don't want to have that thing, that final argument at the end that's shaping in the whole.
Yeah. Yeah. Therefore, Nietzsche is this.
Right.
You want to say, you know, it does this. And to me, if you read any text truly empirically and you come at it, it is multiple. Everything is multiple.
Mm-hmm.
It just is. And that, the more rigorous teleological, your critique or your reading becomes, you have to eliminate the differences. And you can't include all the differences, because that would just be handing in the book itself. I mean, that's the great phenomenological joke, right? Like, I'm going to do a phenomenology of Nietzsche's essay. Here's Nietzsche's essay. You know, it's the Borne story, right? They make a map and they want to make it more and more precise until it becomes the size of the earth and covers where they are.
Right, right.
So it's not that, but you're just trying to have this little gesture, this little trope, this little figure, this little way of weaseling in, but allowing the multiplicity to stand rather than forcing the text into this one thing. So it's really about giving them different kinds of shapes, of arguments, different kinds of flows, different kinds of ways things can go together, rather than a hierarchy. Right. And that gets tricky and very nebulous and can be quite frustrating, but it's something that gets learned in the act of living, in the act of reading. And sense itself is something that is multiple, but has a form. It's open, but it has a form. Right. And we know that when you walk in a room. And you say, this room has a certain sense to it. You know, it has a mood, has an atmosphere, has an ambience.
Uh-huh.
And it's grounded in the empirical, if you will, but that empirical includes the invisible world, the affect, the mood. I don't like it here. You know, it's not just the chairs are uncomfortable. There's something doesn't work here, and you can try to piece that together into a shape, into an argument.
This is the first of four programs in which I want to question some of the assumptions usually made about the tradition of European painting. That tradition which was born about 1400, died about 1900. Tonight, it isn't so much the paintings themselves which I want to consider, as the way we now see them, now in the second half of the 20th century, because we see these paintings as nobody saw them before. If we discover why this is so, we shall also discover something about ourselves and the situation in which we are living.
On the subject of that, of your son's school project, just off to the side, when I was in grade school in the 70s, a friend of mine had a Time Life book of life on other planets, what it would be like. And one of them was, you know, what kind of creatures could possibly, conceivably, theoretically, hypothetically live on Jupiter. And it was these big, they had these big floating gas eaters that would, you know, they were mostly just a membrane.
That's what he's creating. He has these pictures and he calls it like a gas eater. And it's just like it lives on these different, very particular gases that reach different temperatures and form the membrane. I was like, what's the membrane? Is it carbon based? He's like, no, it's the material on the planet sticking because cold absorbs. I mean, he has this whole system.
Right. Well, that's funny. He's doing as well as whoever wrote these Time Life books.
Incredible. I wonder if I can find him. That's great.
So you set him off on this philosophical quest to figure out how those floating gas bags are managing to be alive and conscious to begin with.
Yeah. Well, poor kid. Poor kid. I mean, sometimes I always tease him. I'm like, no matter, I finish saying something and then I play his role for him. Dad, you're so annoying.
What is imminent reading?
So imminent reading is beginning with the event, beginning with the thing rather than beginning with the categories. Right? So one of the great sort of postmodern moments in, you know, Derrida really explodes this out in like he is considered, you know, the beginning of post-structuralism, post-structure. He's like, because the very constitution of a category is made by its examples. I only know what New Wave cinema is from those particular films. Right?
Right.
So, and yet when I go to read something, I see a film, I go, oh, I'm going to look for all the signs of New Wave cinema. And then I say, oh, look, that's New Wave cinema. But the only way I knew New Wave cinema was from the thing.
Right.
So this hierarchical, the teleological, what I call exemplary reading in the book, begins with a category that it puts outside the critical scope. Right. So we watch the film and then we say, oh, I'm going to put it in a drawing. I'm going to show in my essay how this is an example of New Wave cinema. I'm like, well, what's happened here? Nothing's happened. Because you're relating everything back to a known quantity, something that hasn't been considered critically. You're assuming that there is such a thing as New Wave cinema, which only exists because of the thing you're reading. So you're in this weird teleological cycle, and yet, which I love that teleological cycle, and yet you're allowing one term to dominate the other. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
And it takes all kinds of forms, like ideology critique. I'm going to do a Marxist reading. I'm going to do a Lacanian reading. But then the particular thing is lost or is subsumed, not really lost, subsumed by the bigger thing, by the category.
Right.
Meanwhile, the category goes unquestioned. It's not in the scope of critique. It's out of purview. It's out of focus. With imminent reading, you begin wherever you are and you just go from there. And you assume that each thing creates its own science, is its own education, is emergent rather than being exemplary. Rather than being an example of something that precedes it, it itself creates its own categories of which it's an example. So you begin with each thing being kind of sui generis, each thing being a particular.
We're talking about our sons in this conversation, so I'll talk about my oldest son, Ben. He recently took a course at Portland Community College in film theory or film, I think film appreciation maybe. And it was, on noir. films. And he had to write a paper about it for the course. And so he and I watched a number of examples of noir films, Double Indemnity, Vertigo.
The Big Sleep?
He watched that. I didn't watch it with him, but yes. So, and then he had to write a paper, and I have to pick a film. I should pick a film. And I said, well, Blade Runner's on the list. Do Blade Runner, because I'm a Philip Dick fan. And so then he has a list of criteria for noir films, like, does the femme fatale feature in this film? And so I have to find the femme fatale in Blade Runner. I can't quite figure out who the femme fatale is. And because there really isn't, if you compare it to Double Indemnity, there is no femme fatale, right? Not in Blade Runner. So I said, well, the thing to remember is noir is a category that the French imposed on these early American thrillers. Like, no one set out to make a noir film.
Yes, sir.
You know, these are things that have been imposed on it. They're there, but so you come back to, now, if you watch Blade Runner, that's in the 80s. That's after noir has been invented as a category. And you've got people who are, again, probably not aiming at making simply a noir film based on these criteria, but are playing around with that concept. So the question to ask is, how has the femme fatale changed over time?
Yep.
And how is, the culture, if you're going to do like a cultural criticism, how has the culture and maybe feminism and things like that changed the way filmmakers approach the femme fatale? And what is her role in the film? And maybe neo-noir or something like that. Yep. And so then you can say the femme fatale is the android in
the obvious sense,
yeah. Right, and then you can say, well, how is she different than earlier?
Yeah,
noir?
Well, it's funny. So in the beginning of my book, I sort of lay out these sort of terms of exemplary reading, in which I use Pynchon, as example, or I say William Burroughs. William Burroughs is an example of postmodern literature, and then I can argue he is. I can say these are the conditions of postmodern literature, and he fits all them. Check, 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 check. Or I can say he does these different things, and that changes the definition of the category of postmodern literature. Or I can say he's disobedient. He doesn't fit postmodern literature. And those are the choices left up to us with a certain technology, with a certain mechanism of critique. Immanent critique would just begin saying, I don't have to consider those outside categories. I can or I cannot, but in either way, they're not determinative, right? They're not above the thing. So, when I do my reading of Burroughs in the book, I talk about the speed and the viscosity of flows within the book, right? So to me, it was just like this truly empirical reckoning of his prose, rather than coming to it with all these categories that have already determined it and then figuring out whether he fits or doesn't.
So is my reading of Blade Runner then still kind of teleological and?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And again, there's nothing wrong or bad. It sounds super freaking interesting. But what you really begin talking about there is the history of a category of noir, right, rather than about Blade Runner.
Yeah. I thought of it as being a Hegelian read, where you see how contradictions, come up in the category, and then through resolution change the category itself. So you're no longer,
which is again super. There's nothing wrong with doing even a Lacanian reading, which was popular in the rhetoric department. The students after my class had to take a class with this professor who was known for her Lacanian film theory and making students do these readings. And my students would sometimes go in there and stir some shit, because they'd be like, Coffin says we're not supposed to read like this. And I think it's one reason I got kind of blackballed. But I was like, no. I'm teaching this. Doesn't mean that other form doesn't have value. I'm just showing that it's only one way to go.
Right.
Right. And that in itself is entrenched in a certain ideology, and I'm teaching a different way. And it was always the conundrum. I was like, if rhetoric is the way of ways, including the way that rejects the way of ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you say if rhetoric is or this imminent reading just is open to all perspectives. Well, of course, it has to be open to the perspective that says there's only one perspective.
You're saying that you're going to start with the particular thing itself rather than any categorical impositions on it, which from a philosophical perspective, my, you know, old-fashioned philosophical perspective almost sounds like a knowledge claim.
Yes.
I know the thing in itself. I know the particular, the material, the factual, the thing right there. I don't have to meet. There's nothing mediated about my experience of it. I know it. It's concrete, right. And that's where I'll start, is with my material understanding. But you're not quite saying that, are you?
No, because the thing itself, it's just a different. It's taking all those elements. It's not saying that the thing itself is a pure knowable thing that I can know. It's that it is a multiplicity that includes all those categories. So Blade Runner or The Big Sleep, they have noir in them. Unless I'm reading them, I've never heard of noir, which is okay too. Right? So I don't have to have certain knowledge in order to make sense of a movie. I don't have to have certain knowledge in order to make sense of James Joyce. When I was in college, there was a class there taught on Ulysses, and it was some big name guy who wrote the book on Ulysses, and all my English major friends took this class. And then summer after college, I read Ulysses. I was just, you know, and I was hanging out with my friend, and she kept saying, "Are you on that chapter? You're on the Cyclops chapter?" And she kept trying to relate it back to the course she had taken. I was like, I just want to read as a novel. Like, fuck off. Like, I don't care about your categories. I don't think there's a – that's just one way to read it, but let me read it the way I'm reading it, you know? And the point being, you don't need certain knowledge to allow you to critique something. That if it's – if you know nothing about noir, you've never even seen a movie before, and you watch Blade Runner, there's plenty to say, and you can make a critique. No other knowledge is necessary.
But you tell the students, and this is really important, you can make a critique without having prior knowledge. But at the same time, you can't just make a critique based on your biases or your opinions or what you're right. walking in with. So you need to be open to experiencing and being shaped by whatever it is you're critiquing.
And all the things you have in you are also part of it, right? So somebody who's a film buff, you know, I don't even know what that means. Somebody who's an historian of noir is going to be different than, you know, Ben Lane taking the class. They're going to have different perspectives. They bring to it, you know, he probably knows a ton more about video games or whatever the kids into these kids are into these days, you know? And that should inform that reading of Blade Runner. And Blade Runner itself, or any text, anything is multiple. And it's not that it's closed or solipsistic. It's that it always already a network of effects, concepts, affects, moods, modes, speeds, temperatures, intensities, flows. And when you're critiquing it, you find a way through all that. And you say, hey, look how this all fits together in this funny kind of weird way and does this. As opposed to plugging it into a category. Or saying how it fits or doesn't fit, or undoes patriarchy or reaffirms patriarchy, or right.
Mm-hmm.
None of those things. Everything's up for grabs, right? In imminent reading, everything's in motion. Everything flows. No figure is finally determinative. Not the author, not the ideology, not the historical circumstances, not the intent, not the reader's, you know, feelings. None of those things determine. They all play a role. They all configure this elaborate event of critique, of reading, of making sense of things. But the locale, I mean, I really see it almost in the podcast I just did on my blog. I talk about in the book too. Like, you go to a museum, and I was just at the new monstrosity of MoMA here in San Francisco. And you look at a painting, what does everybody do the minute they look at the painting? They look away from the painting to the writing on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is the clearest architecture, right, of a certain kind of sense making. In an exemplary sense making, I'm looking away from the thing to something else and then back to the thing. What I'm suggesting is, what happens if you take that writing on the wall away and you just look at the thing. And it there is always going to be some kind of writing on the wall, which is your experience, which is the context, the fact that you're in a museum. All kinds of things are coming into play. But there's no official structure of the things that to determine the meaning of looking at this really boring Frank Stella painting, right? And that imminent reading makes every reader equally an authority, right? Sort of eliminates the expert, eliminates the will to the definitive, because every text is multiple. And so it doesn't have an answer. There's no key. There's no final place I'm dropping it in. I can't say, you know, this is the definitive book on Burroughs and it says he's postmodern literature, so it is. It's like, right. Well, here's one way to read Burroughs. Here's another way to read Burroughs. Here's another way to read Burroughs.
Right. Well, I recently had did a couple podcasts about drone music with a music professor. And one of the things that she mentioned was that drone music and postmodern music was the music of the manifesto. Huh. Because in order to understand the music, you needed to make a claim. But basically, the music itself didn't make a claim for itself. That the music was put out there because it didn't seem to come from a tradition. It was so open. Anything could become music. So then you had to impose, you know, your manifesto, your claim on the work. And, whereas traditional classical music, I mean, we actually came to this together. It wasn't this was not her argument. This was an argument that emerged with me. Maybe this is my argument, but traditional classical music, you know, it already had a description that everyone understood before it was even written down. That that understanding harmony was something you did after you experienced harmony. And, so I'm wondering if in imminent reading, you're talking about, works that are so mired in a tradition, or that when you read them, you don't, or when you see a work of art, that's a better example. When you see a work of art that is mired in a tradition that you already comprehend, you don't need to look to the wall to read its claim or manifesto or its explanation or description. You already are doing that interpretation.
Yeah, although I
knew I'm giving you a problem, aren't I?
But. Yeah, no. I'm just trying to think about how to come at it. So again, it's really just a different focal point of the beginning of, and then where you're headed. So eliminating the teleology from it, of trying to put it in somewhere and already knowing it and then putting it somewhere. I have a friend here who in San Francisco who makes, you know, ambient sort of drone-ish music, Mark Kate. And I helped him think a little bit about his last record called Despairer, which I highly recommend. It is as the title suggests. And this is not music I know squat about. I know nothing. I don't know the other artists in this genre. If it is a genre, do we even need a genre? I'm not even sure what genre is. So I was just listening to it, you know, in his living room. And I had a lot to say about it, right? Because it's highly affective. And I was just, I had all kinds of things to say about its structure and its affect. And I know some things about music. Why? Because I've heard some music before. But I don't know this genre. I don't know its history. I don't know the other practitioners. He might be making all kinds of gestures that are internal to it, right? You know, the way a lot of contemporary art speaks to other art, and there are those moves that you're going to miss, right? If you don't know your art, but there's still something happening, right? Just because I don't see that doesn't mean I don't understand it or can't do a good critique of it. Or not even a good critique. Do a critique at all. Make a sense of it. I don't have to read that freaking writing on the wall to have someone else tell me that this was an important work because it transformed, you know, our ideas of identity. You know, I mean, museum people love to say that the whole notion of identity. Really, the whole notion of identity. Same sort of general. But none of those. I don't need any of those things, right? Anybody, anywhere can make sense of anything. And, you know, there's a belief definitely about art and so-called high literature, that it needs someone else to explain it. And that's just freaking nonsense, right? Like, it doesn't mean that someone won't give you a good reading of it and you'd be like, oh yeah, thanks, man. Like, you've thought about this more than I have. Awesome. Right? And that person might or might not be well versed in the history of art, the history of film, the history of literature. But I can still make my sense. I can still read James Joyce and find my pleasures and delights and value without making these detours through category, through genre, through expertise, through scholarship.
I would like tonight to talk a little bit about Deleuze's fascination with animals. He always displayed a deep interest for ethology, the science of animal behavior and the study of animal behavior. And he was very serious in the way he took Nietzsche's warning against being human, all too human. For him, it was, particularly for artists, one of the greatest dangers that an artist could fall into, to live only within the small provincial world of humanity. Not that there's not much to express about humanity, not that the humans don't have a really wide range of feelings and emotions to be expressed, not that humans have not a wide range of skills and capacities to perform this expressivity, but there is a danger of closing ourselves into ourselves, to believe that we are the crown jewel of evolution, to believe that we were meant by God to be what we are, to believe that we were the chosen animals and we were given this paradise to use whatever way we wanted to. Of course, we are living in periods where ecological crisis and global warming, another terrible consequences of our industrial behavior and our practices, have woken us to the fact that we are not alone in this planet, and that we need to be the guides of this planet, not the owners and dirty owners of the planet.
Your interpretation of Deleuze,
yeah,
is it different from the dominant reading of Deleuze that we encounter, say, on the left?
Maybe. I mean, you know, Alexander Galloway wrote a piece maybe last year called Forget Deleuze, and he broke the Deleuzians into a bunch of different camps. And he's like, the only Deleuze that's really worthwhile is when he was going through a sort of radical Marxist phase, mm-hmm. these very particular years and these very particular books. And they had all these different categories of Deleuzians. And one of them was, you know, he called the Carl Sagan Deleuzians, who were talking about the billions and billions of multiplicities and flows. And, I wrote a reply on my blog to that, but I was like, I don't know why that's poo-pooed. Like, I'm that guy. So I always found in Deleuze this radical joy, this affirmation, his constructivism, the world endlessly coming into being and creating itself. This sort of his Baroque sensibility, very Leibnizian. And some people, you know, hear me talk about it and are like, yeah, but Deleuze is all about breaking shit down. And that's just, okay. That's just not my Deleuze. You know, like, power to you to have your Deleuze. I see that in there too. It's just, I see that playing a different role, right? I to me, he's one of the great plenists, right? And he's a believer in the plenum and the as opposed to the nothingness, as opposed to the nothing. And, you know, I think he's in that Leibniz tradition, in the Nietzschean tradition of sharing that view. And Nietzsche is one of the great, is the great philosopher of joy. Wrote a freaking book, right? The joyful knowledge, the gay science. And that's, so I come to Deleuze that way. And that's my metabolism. That's how I flow through it. But it is truly multiple. I mean, that's 1,000 plateaus, right? I mean,
right.
There's a lot of ways in. And so I think there's many schools that pick up on what they see as more radical, although I see joy as the ultimate radical move. People read Deleuze differently than I do, no doubt.
You need to be a Marxist of some kind or another to be if you're a Deleuzian, you'd have to have a little bit of Marx in you in order to start staking out a claim of the right way to read Deleuze, right? Because I think one of the reasons I really like your approach to Deleuze is, and this is because I like Marx so much, is because I can see it clearly as something different from other kinds of critical theory, and that it's a competing idea. It's not taking Marx up and doing, you know, and making Marx, it's not correcting Marx. It's doing its own thing. And I like that. And, but when you've been, like, you were on the Partially Examined Life, and I guess while that was a very successful podcast, a lot of people listened, I think, because they always do, and you got a big response. You got a lot of negative response too.
Yeah.
From what did people say about your Deleuze, when you were on the PEL, the Partially Examined Life?
The main thing I remember is actually somebody, she was less put off by my reading of Deleuze or the fact that Deleuze didn't sound like philosophy at all, that it sounded just too flaky and nothing. Probably not supposed to admit this kind of thing, but I definitely shy away from these exchanges because I really like the proliferation of voices. Like I want someone to have a different reading of Deleuze than I do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that's just a good thing to me. I don't think I have the reading of Deleuze. I have my reading of Deleuze. And at some point you don't want to call it Deleuze. I don't really give a shit. I'm not a Deleuze expert. I don't want to be.
Right.
And that poses certain problems, you know. I know on Partially Examined Life at one point, they actually first asked me to do the podcast on Bergson.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Bergson is very close to me, but I said to them, I said, I think what you guys want is a certain level of command of the material. With Bergson, I can't. I can claim an intimacy, but I can't claim a command. With Deleuze, I've read everything. I've read it in freaking French, right? Like I can claim that expert's status if I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't interest me. I don't need to be the Deleuzian. That's why I left the academy, really, or never really participated at that level, wrote a book on Deleuze. Cause it's not interesting. I don't want to exhaust something. I think that there's two problems that come up for me with people reading me, you know, and my take on Deleuze. One is it's not the Deleuze they recognize, or it's not the Deleuze they want to recognize.
Right.
There's a lot of Deleuzians who more and more who, when I was first talking about Deleuze, you know, in the rhetoric department, my professors at the time, like Judith Butler and College of Silverman, said it was fucking nonsense. And I, you know, shouldn't really be doing it. You know, and it's years later now and they're pretty entrenched, Deleuze. But at the time, you know, in the mid 90s, it was considered nutty. So, you know, I get these different kinds of responses. One is that's just flaky nonsense. Or your Deleuze is too flaky and I want this other Deleuze, which allows me to, you know, make a banner and march down the street or do whatever it is I'm doing. I don't mean to sound so negative.
Right.
Like power too. If you can find a Deleuze in there to drive your shit, awesome.